Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to Wallaby Destroyers. Mr. Harry Adlam reviews the 39 destroyers that have served the RAN.
And I'm very pleased to actually be able to give this little talk tonight because the destroyers mean a lot to me, particularly considering that our Royal Australian Navy actually kicked off with two destroyers. We were in a very bad state, naval-wise, because we had on station, from the time of Federation of course, an Imperial squadron of which didn't belong to us. We had a Commonwealth Naval Force, which I think the newest ship was built in 1891. They're all small, obsolete, worn out, of very little use. And we also, in our original Prime Minister, had a chap named Barton who didn't particularly want to see the end of the system. He was quite happy to do without a Navy and let's use Imperial Navy. We also had a very, forceful director of the Commonwealth Naval Force in Admiral Crespell, who wanted the Navy. Well, he was up against it because, you know, politicians are like, they make up their mind, they spend the money. So Crespell was bringing out plans all the time, what we needed. Mind you, these plans had all came out actually before Federation materialised. Crespell set down for setting up a good-sized flotilla of destroyers for coastal defence. A destroyer was just coming into Vogue, as you might say, the bugs are being knocked out of them. They're starting to get good-looking ships, quite heavy, for their time. So Creswell decided, well, this is what we want. But he couldn't get any backing from anybody, and particularly not from Barton. Barton wasn't interested at all. Well, Barton was replaced by a chap called Deacon, who was one of those types we meet quite often, didn't like to make a decision at all. He didn't like to upset the boat. They badgered him, so very begrudgingly, he set aside a sum of about, I think it was £125,000, or £250,000 rather, for naval defence in 1907 and didn't do anything with it. Let the matter drop at that. Let's keep the Imperial Squadron on the station. Well, he hadn't reckoned with Creswell, because Creswell wasn't particularly amenable to this sort of thing. He wanted a Navy of our own. Well, we had another change of government then. They were playing musical prime ministers quite often. Like, they didn't know which party was in, which party was out. We got the famous old Andrew Fisher took over, and Andrew Fisher, as part of his election campaign, had promised to do something about naval defence. I strongly suspect somehow that Creswell was behind him, because every letter that Fisher wrote was exactly the same as something Creswell had written, so I think somehow they must have had a bit of an agreement. Anyway, in came Fisher and immediately ordered three torpedo boat destroyers. The funny thing was, he used the money that poor old Deacon had set aside 2 years before and done nothing with. But his method of ordering was rather odd too, because he used the terms of the Colonial Naval Defence Act, which was brought out in 1865, to use them. Now, I don't think this is quite legal, really, because after we weren't colonies anymore, we were a commonwealth. But strange it may seem, our good old friend Deacon didn't go much on this idea. As a matter of fact, in Parliament he voiced it, that he didn't like the idea that Fisher was going to allow these ships to be turned over to the Royal Navy in time of war. He said there was constitutional difficulties involved. But he got it. But he missed out on another couple of people, the Premiers of Victoria and New South Wales, who got into the bandwagon also that they didn't particularly want a Navy of their own, but they reckoned that seeing New Zealand was going to need a battle cruiser for the Royal Navy, a dreadnought, we ought to do the same thing. So we don't want to buy a ship of our own. Let's give them another dreadnought. So this was all hashed out, causing a lot of trouble. They did raise a dreadnought fund, which ended up by building Jarvis Bay, so we got something out of that. Well, we had musical prime ministers happen again. Out went Fisher, and in come another one. So he had to turn around then and do something, because the latest naval conference had decided on the fleet unit. The fleet unit consisted of a battle cruiser, three cruisers, six destroyers, and three submarines plus a submarine depot ship. So they ordered the battle cruiser because it took the longest to build. Then they played musical prime ministers again, and back came Fisher. So he turned around and ordered the two cruisers. He didn't order three because he ordered the third one to be built in Australia, the same as he ordered the third of the destroyers to be re-erected in Australia. This gave us a little bit of expertise at Cockatoo Island to be able to turn out, in my opinion, the finest destroyers ever been built in the world. All came back from those original destroyers that we bought for $250,000, which also included the delivery cost, which when you come English, you wouldn't get much of that money today. They were very small ships, but were well in the time. Well, we had then two destroyers ordered in the UK. The third one was ordered in the UK, but was to be knocked down, shipped out to Australia and re-erected at Cockatoo Island. The cruisers were the same, two to be built there, one 90% built in Cockatoo and some of the parts in the UK. But going back a bit further than that, a fact that a lot of people miss out on, we got into the bandwagon here. The first destroyers arrived in 1910, were what we call the second then generation of destroyer, because the originals were turtleback, big torpedo boats. But 2 years after the Royal Navy decided to build torpedo boats, we built two here in Sydney of the same length. It's been forgotten by quite a lot of people that we were involved in this so very early. I think it's only natural we followed through on this idea, and I can see where Creswell got his ideas from. He'd operated these old ships, he knew what they were like, also seeing what was coming up with the bigger ones. So we started off then with our Royal Australian being, or our Commonwealth Naval Force that time, receiving its first two new ships after being in existence for 9 years. We'd had to put up with a lot of old crocs in the meantime. But after 9 years in existence, we had two brand new ships. Well, I think the easiest way out of this lot would be if we got our projection party to show some of these ships as they run, and we can point out as we go along the development of the particular type. So if you could get it going, please, Ross. Now, some of these photographs, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, are a little bit mellowed over the years because they came from everywhere. Some have come out on an album of mine. Ross Gillette photographed them again, and they're clear enough to be seen, but if the quality isn't as good, well, just remember they're taken off old photographs. This here, we have not been able to decide which ship it is, but it is either Yarra or Warrego. Now here we see the original River Class destroyer. Not a very big ship at all. Primitive, to say the least. The whole superstructure consisted of a little chart house with a compass platform built on top of it. An open bridge, which also contained a searchlight. It had a signal projector up there, plus the wheel, engine room telegraphs. It wasn't much room up there at all, considering that that whole ship was only 24 feet 8 inches wide, being narrow at the face of what was in the middle of the ship, so it was a very narrow little structure. That was the whole superstructure. Now, forward of the chart house was a 4-inch breech loading gun, which was commonly known as a Mark 8, on a pedestal 3 mounting, an earlier type of weapon we don't see today. The difference between these particular guns we might as well get over as soon as we can. The pedestal mounting consisted of a cone which was bolted to the deck, and the carriage traversed on top of the cone. In other words, we had top carriage, which was a cradle containing the barrel and the button recuperator. Just the top of the mounting revolved, the base remained steady. That was mounted on a bandstand in front of the bridge. The method of breech loading, where we loaded our ammunition in a silk bag, or loaded a projectile, then put a silk bag in behind it, closed up a screwed breech which had a mushroom head which bore back on an asbestos pad. So when the gun fired, the gases in the breech expanded, pushed the mushroom back, spread the pad out and sealed the breech off. The gun that they used on these was a modification of the gun that was issued to all large ships. as an anti-torpedo gun, but we call this one a low-velocity gun where you shorten the chamber, shorten the barrel by 5 calibres, and of course drop the muzzle velocity, or the speed which the shell leaves the barrel. Here we have Yarra arriving in Port Melbourne for the first time, or actually at Williamstown. Now you can see there she has not got the gun mounted, but the pedestal is sitting up on the bandstand just here. Now either side of the funnel, the after funnel, you'll notice a little piece which was a platform which hinged out. You can see the big round iron bracket that hinged down to allow the gunner somewhere to stand when they were traversing around. One either side of the after funnel, and one on a bandstand right aft, which you can just see the campus dodger just ahead of the jackstaff. An interesting thing, if you have a look here, you can see that there's three sets of boat davits on that. Very simple, so did Parramatta at that time. Warrego was being built in the UK, but to be built in Australia, so a lot of the gear came out on these ships. So what did we do? We just mounted Warrego's whalers on Parramatta and Yarra for delivery out. It was a cheap method of getting them here, and they had an extra boat. The accommodation of these ships, as I say, was absolutely primitive, which you'll guess by the fact that from that scuttle there to that scuttle there, there were cabins for 4 officers and a wardroom and an officer's bathroom. The scuttles underneath was a forward seaman's mess deck, the chief's and PO's mess, the ERA's mess, and another seaman's mess, and then down aft in the scuttles way aft was another seaman's mess and stoker's mess down there. The bathroom was combined with the heads, which was down below. I think there was 3 hand basins for the crew. 3 for a crew of 75 men. Well, I suppose 3 hand basins would have been enough in those days. No refrigeration at all carried. The galley was down below. And if you want the train number 2 torpedo tube, you took the galley funnel down. These were primitive when you come to them, but in their day they were quite good. You notice the big mushroom bench there for the boiler room air intakes. Here's Warrego, the local built boat, on her trials outside the hedge. A good view of what was on the old River Class destroyer. You see there's nothing much there. They're very small ships. An interesting point here, these are always regarded in the British journals as modified British I-class destroyers, which to me is absolute hogwash. The I-class were built 2 years after our Australian River Class. So we should really call our River Class I-class, and the British boats could be modified Australian I-class. So we'll stick by River Class and let it go at that. Here we have Yarra. You can imagine it's not written by one of our boys, HMS Yarra, up on the dry dock in Italy. Now there you can see the ship. There's not much of them. Triple screws, the rudder hung over the stern like a motorboat. The little funnels there, which you can see, aren't quite as tall as the bridge. You can, a bit hard to pick out on a photograph this size and of this age. But you can see by the way that thing's sitting there, there's not much of it. She was only 245 feet long with a displacement of 700 tonnes. Now imagine 700 tonnes today isn't a very big ship at all. But there we have a good stern view. You can see the condenser outlet on the side there, the draft marks, the 3 shafts. We have Parramatta's back end. Sometime we're going to mount it and you'll see exactly the same rudder. And here we have Swan. This is, we don't exactly know, it's either a wartime or immediately after the war photograph by the pendant number paint on the side, 61. We've also added a shield to the forward gun, which was never there. There's another 2, we don't know who they are. But there's a good view of the long, well, reasonably long, sneaky little ships. Now, this is Huon. When she was finished for service, they used her as a gunnery target. After the gunnery shoot was over, some detestable person did that to it. They blew up a scuttling charge and down she went. Now you can see it's not very far away. The cutter is resting on, is always watching it go. There's not a great deal of force in one of the scuttling charges, but fancy doing anything like that. Over, please, Ross. Get upset with that one. Now here we are, what is left of Parramatta before the Naval Historical Society and a few other people got to it. She hasn't got that piece now, nor the piece down then, but this is the end of the road for old Parramatta up the Parramatta River. Another thing that shouldn't have happened, but it did, and there's nothing much we can do about it. Our first. Now here we have the second group, the flotilla leader Anzac. And ANZAC was one of a group of what was called the later marksman class, different from the earlier marksman class on account of they had three funnels instead of four, and a super firing gun forward. The original marksman class had four funnels of equal height, and they decided to raise the forward one because it was a bit close to the bridge. You notice that the two after funnels are set in sideways. They did that so they could put a gun platform in between the funnels. Now she carried four 4-inch guns, which were a quick firing gun on a pedestal mounting. A quick firing gun, of course, uses a brass cartridge case to seal the escape of gas, and it's quite an easy one to use. It is a standard that we use now. As a matter of fact, the breech block is virtually the same as in present-day use. Also carried a pair of 2-pounder pom-poms as anti-aircraft armament. Rather an odd-looking ship, and there's an old Wally Rounds, engineer commander, had been engineer and officer of this one, and he reckoned she was one of the freaks. He liked it, but it was a bit of a freak. We only had the one that was given to us because of the name ANZAC, no other reason. There were two groups of these. None of them lasted into the Second World War. They were designed to do 34 knots. The best speed I can get any verification from ANZAC was 29. It's still not bad considering that. They were still printed, they were still on direct drive turbines, no gearing and things like that. Still on low steam pressures. A little bit more comfortable than the old Rivers, but really not a great deal ahead of it, with the exception that we've got the super firing gun and we've got all 4-inch now instead of 1 4-inch and 3 12-pounders. The range of the 4-inch gun on those was about 13,000 yards. Now here we have stalwart and ANZAC at sea, taken from another S-boat. Good idea of the fakes on the side here with the single combined capstan cable holder. The jackstaff is set up, which is rather odd. We don't know why they do that. Now here's a classic. This is an S-boat. This is possibly the prettiest looking destroyer that was ever built. Designed with the lessons learnt in the Great War at hand, you know, she's got a rounded forefoot. They'd found out, much their bitter experience, that a great thing is to ram a submarine. And if you ram a submarine, you usually bend the stem that much that you sink the ship anyway, for a big lot of damage. So they decided to do away with these. Didn't need it. 3 4-inch guns and a 2-pounder pom-pom, 4 torpedo tubes. 27,000 horsepower on a ship which light displacement is 905 tonnes, not very much bigger than the rivers, and they're only 21 feet longer, and they were 2 feet wider. Here's the stalwart in dry dock, up at Cockatiel in the old Fitzroy dock there. Get a nice idea of the nice flare of the bow. Very comfortable, they've got the forecastle awning spread. Well, like I say, they must have had a very humane skipper. I never saw a forecastle awning spread in a destroyer. Except to Brook up in Samurai, but that's typical of the RLS bacon, so they weren't very big. Just take the man standing on the dock, and he's got the field blocks ahead of him. And the reason why she's up so high is that the propellers on these ships, the A-bracket, which supported the propeller shaft, was on a line with a keel. When you have a 9'6" propeller, it means that there's at least 4 feet of propeller blade going to hang down below the keel. So she had to be jacked up a fair height to get it. Now here we have success. With the earlier form of differentiating the ships in the flotilla by black bands around the funnel. That didn't last a great deal of time, as we'll see later on. Tasmania originally had one black band around the after stack, and with my time in the Navy, the half black band was the half leader, so I thought, now, she must have been the 2IC, the flotilla, until I started getting into it and found out that they had black bands all over them. This system went in for, I don't exactly know when it dipped out, but it must have gone reasonably early. The pendant number plate on the side HO2, was gone by 1925 when they took our numbers and gave them to the Royal Navy, and we got numbers H2 answering, H3 answering and all that. We never painted the numbers on after that. Here's success taken from the top. Now you can see just how little there was in these old ships. There's not much there. The superstructure, well, like the River Class, we've got a wheelhouse sitting on top of a chart house. which also was the radio room as well, and the skipper's sea cabin, and you name it. It was 15 feet long, so it wasn't much. The bridge in these was covered in, you might have noticed they got a roof over them. The first Australian destroyers to, and the only one for a long time to receive a bridge that was covered. You can see the galley funnel sticking up there, and you can see the semaphore signalling arms, which was quite the go in those days. Down aft you can see a searchlight which sat on top of the after tube bank. It didn't rotate with the tubes, it sat on a frame, the tubes rotated, but it was held fore and aft. There was a little gangway went between the after pom-pom here, the only pom-pom, and ahead of it there was another few uprights which held the searchlight while the tubes rotated around it. The wardroom, by the way, went down there, down under the pom-pom. It was only a canvas dodge around a steel frame. In wet weather, the officers suffered on these ships. The galley was up forward and the wardroom was down aft. And in any sort of weather, I mean a ripple of a wave more than 6 inches, they used to take a bit over the top. Quite often the poor old steward couldn't get the food from the galley down to the wardroom. And Wally Rams was telling me once they did a trip in Swordsman from Sydney to Melbourne, and all they ate was a little bit of ham they had left in the wardroom pantry. They just couldn't get the food to the galley. They never had any refrigerators or anything like that in those days. There was a meat safe on the upper deck. First day at sea, the meat went. Here's another one, which is success in her later life. You'll notice there she's wearing the flotilla leader's broad band around the funnel. A good idea, you can see it there, the rounded off forecastle, of course, semi-turtle back forecastle. The guns are reasonably well covered with canvas. Try and keep them a bit dry. They were quite small ships. You can see the bracket here held the searchlight tower solid with the tubes rotate underneath it. Behind that, of course, is the pom-pom in its little position. And here we have Tasmania. Now, I think when you look at this particular photo, I always go in raptures over this one. To me, that is the perfect destroyer. The lines are there. Now, you can see the edge of the forecastle was rounded off, so she went through the water instead of over. Wally Sampson said something nasty about that in a paper I was reading the other day. He reckoned they spent more time under the water than they should have been in the submarine for a little bit. I don't go with that one. The ship itself, you can see, was a very, very pretty little ship. The machinery in these was the same that went into the V&W destroyers, 27,000 horsepower, and being a much lighter ship, of course, they are that little bit faster. The closed-in bridge, you notice they've got the windows down on the bridge there. I believe that at times they used to have to get them up in a hurry because these ships were a little bit wet at sea, had a good flared forecastle, but the water came right over the top of the bridge. If they hadn't had the roof there, they'd never been able to read a chart. Now here's Tasmania looking from the bridge down over the top. You can see the after funnel. There's the forward tube bank that swung out. The old 13-foot-6 dinghy is hanging on the torpedo boat over the side. Somebody's going sailing. You can see the after 4-inch on its bandstand, and you can see the pom-pom. The searchlights over the after tubes, and you can just see where the two officers standing by the gangway, you can see the depth charge thrower, sighted either side of the pom-pom, the pom-pom platform. The depth charges for these were stowed under the after bandstand. Not much room, so you had to put everything where you could. Here's Tasmania again, a good side-on view. Now this old photograph was taken by an old stoker guy named Big Gun. I didn't think it was going to come out, but Ross didn't do a bad job. If you can see the shadow of it, it was taken through a scuttle in another ship. And it was a good idea of exactly what the OS boat looked like. And if you look through, that was completely open underneath. It was a platform that held the chart house, was just extended back from the forecastle. The two air intakes for the boiler rooms were there, and very little else. The reason for that being, these ships were originally designed to mount a single 18-inch torpedo tube on either side. The idea didn't work out very well, so they never progressed with it. We didn't. These ships, by the way, were taken over by the RAN brand new. Presented to us by the Royal Navy at the end of the war in 1919. As they were finished, they were steamed down to a reserve anchorage down in Devonport. We had to wait till 1920 until we could get a crew to bring them all out. Brand new ships when we got them, and to be quite frank, our brand new ships when we sailed them as scrap. The average S-boat did no more than 6 years' service, yet the governments have always had the audacity to say, and I say audacity in this case, that we borrowed the BMWs on loan to replace the older, worn-out S-class, and considering the Vs and Ws were built only up to 2 years before these, and were worn out when we got them, and these things, with the exception of Tattoo, which was the only one that managed to last any length of time, although she spent a lot of time reserved too, well, they were in good condition. There's Tasmania laying a smoke screen. You notice we're making smoke from the funnels and the white smoke from the CSA smoke plates on the quarterdeck. Your method of making smoke in those days was more drastic than what it is, or what it was I knew. There was, set into the top of each furnace was an open pipe, which you just sprayed coal oil down onto the furnace floor, and you can, anybody who's had anything to do with burning oil fuel, you know what happened. It goes very black. Very good too. It made good, thick, dense smoke, and combined with the CSA smoke plates, it went well. The only choice, it took a hell of a long time to clear the furnace afterwards. It's oil everywhere. We'll get over this in later years by just merely pushing the air registers around the burners in a little bit, and then that certainly made smoke, and then to clear it, you just pulled the air register out again. But that was the method they used in those days. Now here we've got two of them, Success and Tattoo, both laying a smoke screen side by side. Now look at the pretty little lines on them. Really beautiful destroyers and fast. I think until the advent of Warramunga, which could do 36 and a half on trials, these would have been the fastest destroyers, and I think I remember Captain Hinchcliffe saying once they were the fastest in the southern hemisphere in their time, and I'd go along with that. Have a look at them, aren't they? They look lovely. Beautiful little ships. Sailed us back. We sold them, well, we paid them off because somebody reckoned they were worn out and obsolete, and we borrowed a flotilla leader and four V&W class destroyers from the RN. Now here's Stuart, our original, or our second flotilla leader. The notification underneath is, actually comes out of my album. Stuart, Admiralty Large Design Scott Type, which is the official designation, normally known as the Scott class. That is the full title. The Admiralty Large Design of Flotilla Leader, Scott Type. Now there she is, a beautiful looking ship. This is as she was as an escort when they've reefed just about everything off it. You'll notice that the A-gun's gone, torpedo tubes are gone. Doesn't look much the same. They made a worse job of that later on. They took everything, put a 1/4-inch gun on the front end of it, and practically nothing else, and took the forward stack away, and it looked a terrible looking thing. Dropped out of the destroyer line then, so we can forget that. But that is Stuart, well known, and of the V's and W's, the fastest. She could do about 34 knots. A very well one known here now, Vampire. Good shot of the V&W. So the salient features were very similar to the Anzac, with the exception that the gun between the funnels wasn't put there, and we put a super firing gun down aft. These had a bit of heavier gun than the S-class. This was a 4-inch Mark V, which was a 45 caliber gun, and we've got another 900 yards range. Originally, a funny thing happened here. They were designed and mounted a 3-inch 20-100 weight anti-aircraft gun behind the funnels. After the war, somebody decided that you didn't need a 3-inch gun, a pom-pom's all you need, so they took the 3-inch gun off and put a pom-pom on them. When we got them, they had a pom-pom. When they got out of the med, the first thing they did there was take the pom-pom away and replace it by a 4-barreled half-inch Vickers machine gun, which was next to useless. We also pulled the after tube bank off and put a 12-pounder in there, so we got back to virtually what we did have, only with one tube bank less. But this is the sort of thing my Lord's Commissioners Admirals do from time to time. Another well-known one, Vendetta. Possibly the best known of the lot, our Vendetta. That's a good shot of a going past GI there. You can see everything that's with it. Quite a nice looking ship and quite a good old one. This is a rather unusual one. This was taken in Singapore just before she was towed out. She was up there on the throes of a dockyard refit. As you can see by the general condition, everything's heaped all over it. They were getting it ready to take out. Now, the Petty Officer Telegraphist that took this, Dave Moody, was one of the party that was left behind in Singapore to supervise the refit. Now, Dave's story on this one doesn't quite tally up with the official version. Dave's dead now, unfortunately, but I have no doubt that Outing was a very honest man. What he told me was this, that when this particular ship was under repair and it couldn't steam, most of the gear was ashore, the Admiralty weren't particularly worried about it because things were in a turmoil there and they were prepared to leave it. So the chief stoker and the coxswain commandeered a dockyard tug and laid the ultimatum down, if you don't do something about Vendetta, we're going to take her out in the middle of the harbour and sink it ourselves. Well, it must have had their desired effect, so they towed her out. The only gun they had that they could use at the time was the old 12-pounder. And Bill Lace, I think a lot of you might remember old Bill, the old gunner too. Bill went ashore to get some ammunition for the trip back. Now, mind you, Singapore was on the way up. Magazines were full, and the naval stores officer there graciously gave him 24 rounds to get back to Australia. The Japs got the rest, but it didn't make any difference. But that's an unusual one of Vendetta. I don't think this one's been published before. Now here's a good one taken over in Auckland, pre-war with the Sydney, the Water Hen and the Vendetta. Now you can see just what tiddly looking little ships they were. Notice the ship's crest up in front of the little open compass platform there. There must have been a little bit less hardy on Water Hen. They've got an awning over the compass platform. Vendetta hasn't. There's the old Sydney there with its old Pusser's duck in between the funnels. It's quite a good shot showing the lines of these old ships. I won't tell you how I come to get that one. The Daily Telegraph might go mad. A Runter. Our local built design. Well, not local built, but they weren't designed local. They were a modification of the Royal Navy's super destroyer in between the wars. Much bigger and heavier than the average destroyer at that time. Armament was pretty formidable in the original. They had 8 twin 4.7 mountings and a 4-barrel pom-pom and 4 torpedo tubes, plus the sundry machine guns. Early experience in the war showed that that particular arrangement was quite good against surface work, but like all destroyer guns up there, they couldn't elevate any distance, and 40 degrees was all that mounting could do. So X-mounting was removed and a 4-inch Mark 16 twin was put in its place to give us some anti-aircraft potential, which was copied by everybody else later on. As a matter of fact, the Canadians ended up by arming their ships for that same twin 4-inch. But that is a Runter as she was originally built. Now, three ships of this class, a Runter, Warramunga and Bataan, and the three were all different. They all built the same general plan. You could always pick them out. The gun tubs and the funnel, around in between the funnels, which originally carried all the guns. In a Runter, they were squared off, flat section. Warramunga was built with hers round. Even the two ships there, you could pick it. The Runter was built with a full number of pre-war shipside scuttles in it, and later they plated about 50% of them over. Warramunga was built with just the wartime issue. Never got any more. Now there's a Runter at the end of her day. This is well and truly after war. She's been converted now from a destroyer into an anti-submarine escort. And if you look closely, you can see on the gun tubs there, you can see the squared sides of them. There's still the remainder. She's got a tripod, or a latticework mast in this case, in wartime modification. She's got also the post-war emergency conning position down aft. She's lost the after 4.7, but she's retained the twin. She lost depth charge equipment and gained the famous old squid. Squid was the ants' pants in those days. It was quite good. You fired three heavy mortar bombs over the top of the ship and into the water ahead of you. The original drill was you followed up and they blew up underneath and gave the boiler room's engineering crews quite a start. So we modified the drill later and peeled off to one side. Enough for 10 full salvos, which when you come here it doesn't sound much. But with three squid bombs you had a chance of sinking a submarine much better than you did by putting 10 dozen depth charges on the old one. They're pretty hefty, pretty good. They were mounted down aft in place of the old 4.7s. We've got now all, at this time we had single barrel Bofors replacing the Orlikans, which were put on during the war anyway as far as that goes. But they were slightly heavier than the original design with the extra work that went onto them. More about that when we come across Warramunga, but that's a good one of a runter. Now here we have Warramunga in its original form. You can see she's still got the old semaphore arm sticking up in the ring of the bridge. She's got a pair of WT spreaders on the after control position of the searchlight. You can see the 4-inch twin sticking out. Not a bad looking ship, you know, when you come look at it, they were quite nice. Quite fast. Warramunga was the fastest of the three. They never went as fast after the conversion, admittedly, but then again they put a lot more weight on them. But that is the original design. This is Warramunga doing her original trials. Now, we'll just point out something as we go along. This is Warramunga doing her second trials, and if you look at the fourth man from the right on the top of the bridge there, you'll find him sitting up in about the third row from the back tonight. Mm-hmm. That was Warramunga doing her first full power trials, where we were able to get three boilers alight. The refit of this ship was an absolute disgrace, and I think Dockyard Garden Island will always hold their head in shame over it. That was the second time we got to see. The first time we could only go out in two boilers because that's all that had worked. But if you can have a look at the condition of the ship there, she was coming better. It was nowhere near the immaculate condition the average Australian destroyer has always kept than she was later on. But there we have the modifications that have happened as an anti-submarine escort. There's an emergency conning position. We've taken the pom-pom away and we'll put twin bopers behind it with a Type 6 sight to control it. The emergency conning position is nice and covered in. The Chinese laundryman used that while we were up in Singapore. That was there, little caboose, and the two ship's monkeys, Hickey and Blinky, lived up there. There's the few differences that you can pick out, quite obvious. But the general idea of the ship was the same, except that the after deck house just made it look a little bit heavier, if anything. That photograph, I've seen that put down as RIN official, everything else. I'll give it the acknowledgement. I bought that from the ship's canteen in Warramunga 3 days after it was taken. So, as far as I'm concerned, that's a ship's photograph. Now here she is, Warramunga, as an anti-submarine escort. This is taken after I left it because we've lost the whaler. The whaler used to be ahead of the motor cutter there on the starboard side. Why they took the whaler off, I'll never know. Now, an interesting point with these ships, they had a little gaff on that after funnel. When we commissioned Warramunga alongside Garden Island, we had to raise the ensign to the gaff because the mainmast down aft wasn't ready. And while I was watching, I had a pretty good view of it. I was standing right alongside. That little funnel supplied number 3 boiler. Commander Hinchcliffe got up and read the official commissioning warrant and said, "I'll hoist the white ensign." Up she went up this little gaff on that back funnel, and I almost burst out laughing because the waste steam pipe to number 3 boiler had been swung into place by the dockies, bolted into position and painted. Looked really nice, except they'd left the steel wire strop that they used on the crane still around and painted over that too. That was honestly one of the worst refits I think Garden Island's ever done. We went out to sea, we couldn't hold air pressure in the boiler rooms, therefore we couldn't get very much out of it. We would have been in dire straits if either the oil fuel pumps packed up, because there was no oil fuel transfer line. If you lose one boiler, we can get the other one. You couldn't do it in this one. We had no lighting in the boiler rooms except festoons of electric light bulbs just hanging down. It was a bad commissioning, but the old ship turned into one of the best. There she is. That's the end of the road. She's going out. You can see it there. Neglected. The guns are on there. We've saved the twin 4-inch, by the way. It must have been good, but the old 4.7s were, of course, were out of date, finished. There'd been oxy cut put through the barrel and through the breech, so nobody even used them again. But nowhere near the smart ship she was. Now, Bataan. The third of the group, that's the way she was built. She was built with that lattice tripod, that lattice foremast rather. She was built without the after control position. She was built with bofors. She never replaced organs for bofors and things like that. That was the final, should we say, fighting appearance of the tribal as a fleet destroyer. Now, something I was meant to mention in Warramunga, with that after control position, the Japanese kamikazes proved up in Lady Gulf that
handling going too, so it goes, that the oilerkin just wasn't good enough. So Warramunga was whipped down into a dockyard in Manus, and in the space of 48 hours, the Warramunga's crew, as well as the Americans in their dockyard, got to work. They landed all the oilerkins, replaced them with 6 single-barrel Bofors. They cut off the after-control position. They cut off the searchlight tower, the WT spreaders and everything else. And the chief gunner's mate, Don Walker, manufactured and cut a safety cam to give the old four-barrel pom-pom a complete 360-degrees arc of fire. It was a really elaborate thing because it climbed up the mast and everything else. You know, but it was all done in 48 hours by sailors. I'd say that from what I could see of that refit of Warramunga in the dockyard here, 15 weeks. So a bit of difference. The N class. Here's Nizam. Ike Cowley come out with this photo. I don't think anybody remembers how Ike Cowley. Very proud of this photo when he bought that engine. There's a real ship for you. Well, the N class were the group that were being built or designed pre-war, the last of the pre-war designed destroyers. We commissioned 5 of them. They wanted to take the full flotilla over. We never had them in. The original move was to take Waller out of Ahmed with his boys and give them those ships, but they couldn't spare Waller either. So we commissioned them as they were built, the 5 of them anyway. Nizam was commanded by Lieutenant Commander Clark, who died recently. I see his name in the last post. 3 twin 4.7 mountings and 10 torpedo tubes in 2 quintuple mountings. The old elusive 4-barrel pom-pom behind the funnel, 0.5 machine guns on either side of the bridge. Not a very good weapon, the old 0.5. They were soon ousted and oilerkins replaced them. The after tube bank was removed and a 4-inch Mark 5 high angle gun was given there to give them some anti-aircraft protection. Mind you, these 4.7 could still only elevate to 40 degrees. I mean, they weren't designed for anti-craft work. You notice the 2 mine-sweeping davits on the stern. They are fit up with the famous old destroyer 2-speed sweep gear, which I believe they were used quite often. The searchlight in the little platform between the tube spaces. There's radar saw at the end of the searchlight, and I think the boys were glad because they got bofors in their place. Tripod mast. The HA director and the low angle director up on the compass, behind the compass platform there. Typical standard British destroyer. Now here we have Norman, alongside Queenborough in Sydney Harbour in October 1945, in the changeover, which should never have happened. Evidently, we agreed to this changeover. We requested the queues because we reckoned they had longer range. The 5 remaining ends were to be turned to the RN, and 3 additional Q class were to be added to the 2 quick match and quiverin that we already had. Sounded pretty good, except the Qs only had 4 4.7s, 4 single mountings, and of the 3 of them, quadrant only was of any use. Queenborough was turned over to us with 1 boiler burnt out, and they stay alongside Garden Island and Applebyte, Watson's Bay, anywhere until they decide to make a fast frigate out of it. The ends, on the other hand, were in very, very good condition, very clean. You'll notice there the pendant number D16. All Australian and British destroyers working with the British Pacific Fleet were given a complete new signal code number with D pendant superior. I always thought that they wiped the D number the day the war was finished, but this is October, after it had finished, and there's Norman still carrying her D16 pendant. Here we have quick match. The Q class, as I originally built. Billy Kendall came out with a very funny one here the other day. Commissioned Quiverin with the commander that the RN commander that commissioned it, Commander Browning, brother of Roy Browning, the famous British general, and he tried to instill into the RN ratings a little bit of finesse that we lacked. And he said, the name Quiberon, he said, actually is a French name, which is Quiberon. I wish you'd get used to calling it Quiberon. So straight away, they used to call the ship alongside the Keymark. So supposed to be quick match, but they reckon if they got a French pronunciation for theirs, they could have the same for the other one. Quick match. Remember old Dusty Rhodes commissioned her, quite well known. There she is again. It's a later photograph from during the war era. As an anti-submarine frigate. Now you can't disguise the hull lines. They built some top hamper onto it. But look at that lovely spoon bead. It's a pity the steel that went into these ships wasn't as good as the lines. I can remember a quick match alongside Garden Island there with a big patch over the petty officer's mess. They didn't have the patch on there. The POs used to get washed out every time it rained. Steel wasn't good in them. Matter of fact, Queenborough, I think, got about a 45% replate of its hull when they rebuilt it. There we have the Q-class modification. Not much. We didn't have much on them. Quadrant. I was never very impressed with this ship. I didn't get much on it. We had a good skipper, Vat Smith, but the ship itself, I never had any love for it. Well, I'm not sorry to see that picture, to quite frankly. As a destroyer, she looked nice. I didn't like that one. The first lieutenant in that, the chap named Marshall, who the next time I heard of him was, unfortunately got mixed up when Woomera blew up. He was skipper of that. But they were a good crowd of officers and men. But I somehow didn't like the ship. There was something wrong with it. It lacked something. Now there's one I am very pleased with, Tobruk. Very pleased indeed. Australian built, the action of the British battle class destroyer, with a few modifications which made ours just a little bit better than theirs. Behind the funnel, instead of the old pom-pom, the Royal Navy put a single gun, either a 4-inch or a 4.5, to use as a star shell gun. We didn't. We built an office block there and put two single bofas up on the top of it, which meant that we'd get the engineer's office, the ship's office, the captain's office, the coxswain's office, the torpedo office, and the gunnery office up from down below and give us more living space for the men. Just by doing that little thing there. If it was going to get hit in action, it wouldn't matter anyway. The guns on these were 4.5 dual purpose. If at last got something, we'll shoot aeroplanes down, 80 degrees elevation. The turrets were of a later type. The British battle class had a much earlier type of turret, which was much shorter. Not as high, they were completely round. Those were very square. We had to build the bridge higher on these to look ahead the top of the taller turrets. These ships were very successful, only built two, Tobruk and Anzac. Tobruk in its light condition, we first did trials, and she only had four 4.5s and nothing else, did 33.9 knots. And under full load condition, we've got 31.9, which was a pretty good speed considering the Admiralty staff requirement for a battle class was 30 1/4 knots. One of the British battles did get up to 32 1/2, 800 tonnes underweight, yet I was reading the famous old Blackwood ships of the Royal Navy, and they say battle class destroyers 35.75 knots. They never ever did it. They are nice looking ships, they are beautiful ships. Comfortable, everything was aluminium. Even putting the nose into the greenies, they were still pretty good. Nothing wrong with those ships. Well armed. All the heavy arm was forward. Behind B turret there, there was a single barrel bofas, one on either side of the wings of the bridge, two on the after platform behind the stack, and one on the quarterdeck on the port side. The rest were three twin, what we call stag mountings, stabilised tachymetric anti-aircraft gun mounting, which was a completely radar-controlled unit, depending on the ship only for power. It had its own search and location radar unit. The officer of the quarters there could start winding a little joystick handle, put the search and the old barrels going, something they'd find something, so they'd lock on, and all they had to do then was watch till it came in range and squeeze the trigger. Quite good too, a very effective weapon, but unfortunately, there's always that type that upset these things by building aeroplanes to go too fast, and it wasn't much good. We had to go for something else. Anzac, the second one of them, built by Williamstown Dockyards against Cockatoo for Tobruk, although the boilers and engines were Cockatoo and a lot of the plates were Cockatoo. This isn't very nice looking at all. They've taken B turret off and they've put a big block of officers or something on the front there, looks terrible. They've taken the tubes away, they've taken the stags up and down aft and they've put another big block down there. But somehow or other there is still that very nice tribal class line. You notice, battle class line rather, you notice on the battle that is against the tribals and the Qs, the edge of the upper deck on the Qs and the tribals was chopped off. And she came up and they chamfered off her nice knuckle. This came straight up. I think it might have detracted a little bit from the appearance, but they were still quite nice looking boats. That is Anzac as we all remember lately. Voyager, taken just a few weeks before she was rammed by the Sydney. I think this class of ship is wrongly named. They should have been called the Ballyhoo class, because there's never been so much ballyhoo about a particular type of uninteresting ship that's ever come out. They used to say they were too big to be destroyers. They're really light cruisers. Well, they look a bit more like it there, but they weren't in the original go. They were exactly the same length, beam and tonnage as an American Gearing class destroyer. They didn't carry as much armour, nor were they as fast. Practically the same design, they had the same boilers, same machinery layout, and to be quite frank, the Daring was a letdown. In this condition here with the rebuild, they're quite an effective ship. The reason why they were letdown is quite obvious. They didn't put two funnels on. Now there's Duchess, you can see that, one little skinny stack sticking up down the back, and the other stack coming up through that lattice mast. You imagine the skip on the bridge. Engine room stopped making smoke through the forward mast. Ridiculous. They could have made a good looking ship out of those things, but they didn't. They gave us a very unbalanced appearance. Everything was built up down aft. Originally they had two tube spaces, which made them look a bit lighter. Not now. Here's the Duchess again, a much nicer photograph of Duchess. But you can see the top of that silly looking thing coming up there. Now you can't compare that with the Triber class with its two funnels or the RLS class with its two funnels. There's something wrong. They did a modification and they tried to do something that after stack, but they might as well left the original on it. It didn't do anything for the ship at all. This is, as a training ship, they've taken the after 4.5 turret off it, built another block on there, taken the tubes away. Never had the same appearance. You always tell Duchess from the Australian boats she had the full row of shipside scuttles, whereas ours were all air-conditioned. We did air-conditioners when we bought it, but you could always pick, irrespective of knowing the pendant numbers, you always pick Duchess by her lines of scuttles, and to be quite frank, it was a much more pleasing appearance. I will go so far as to say that the hull on the Daring class was one of the nicest-looking destroyer hulls that's ever been built. The bull ring, instead of being a big steel forging on the top of the forecastle, was a tube let into the forecastle and nicely chamfered off. Bertrand didn't have one when she finished because she left that underneath where Vengeance had been when she knocked it off. But now we come to the present destroyers we're using now. Like everybody knows Perth. Funny thing about these ships, only carrying two guns now, two 5-inch. Two 5-inch 54 calibre guns on one of these DDGs can lay down a heavier barrage in weight of shell per minute and throw them to a greater distance than the old 8-inch county class cruisers. So we have come a long way. The 5-inch 54 calibre, which is both dual purpose, high and low angle, can fire at a rate of 50 rounds a minute, whereas if we could get four rounds out, the old 8-inch were doing good. Here we are, Hobart, very popular ship. One of our society members was telling me why they always going out on it next week. Let us know what it's like. And here we are, Brisbane, the third of the trio. I think myself, this is one of Ross Gillette's pictures, don't blame this on me, I've never taken a photograph as good that yet. But there you can see the good clean lines, and something that has been in American destroyers for a long, long time. The whole bridge front becomes a breakwater. Any water hits the bridge, shoots out over either side. I think the boys in the B&Ws would have loved to have had that fit in them instead of the 2 feet of water they used to have in the mess decks. But here we are in the modern age now. We've got a funny thing about this. The original Brisbane was four screws to give 25,000 horsepower. This Brisbane, two screws to give 70,000 horsepower. We've come a long way. They're quite big ships, nearly all aluminium. Plenty of rocketry. To finish up, we'll get on to some other ones now. They've been given the title of destroyer escorts. They were originally frigates. They are now destroyer escorts, so they've come into the destroyer range. six ships, three different types, but according to our Navy, all one class, I suppose is the way of grouping them. First two, Parramatta and Yarra, were built to that configuration, which I can't get wrapped up in these ships at all. The lines aren't as nice as they used to be, but the ships are quite versatile, and that particular type of bow, which doesn't look the best, is very effective. Yep, the focal is actually flat, and then there is a nice slope down to a twin 4.5 set down in a little slight well. And as you can see, we've adopted the American idea. We bring our bridge structure right to the side and shoot all the water out that way. Not a bad-looking ship. The second group, Stuart and Waterhen, were fitted for variable depth sonar. So they were built up from one side only, which looks rather odd. If you look from this side, it's flush deck. You look the other side and she dips down. This is only on this side. The BDS has been taken up in the meantime, and I don't know what they use it for now, probably cinema projection room or something. Now the last two, Swan and Torrens, were built to an altogether different configuration. These are actually Leander class frigates. You notice there that the walkaway right around from the forward turret right aft. It's a different upper deck altogether, completely flush deck, with Zycara missile launch on the other side. A completely different upper works on the old standard hull, but these ships have got a rounded forefoot, whereas the other four are straight-stemmed, but the Navy still say they're all the one class. Well, I just can't sort of work that one out. It didn't fit in. Now, here we have a good view. You can see the Zycara missile launcher down aft there. And a good idea of what the ships look like. Somehow we've lost, I think. We haven't got the stately old lines. We haven't got the scuttles in the sides. We've got the American idea of putting the numbers right up on the bow and on the quarter set across the stern. I suppose they may be... Some people would see beauty in them. I can't. I can see it in the T's, in the S's rather. I can see it in the tribals and the Q's. Definitely the tribals. Definitely in the battles, but I can't see anything in these to say that they're beautiful looking ships. Possibly they're twice as comfortable as the old ones would be, so I think we've gained something there. But that is a good shot, that, in giving you an idea of exactly what we've come back to. We've got away from our traditional torpedo and gun arm destroyer, and what have we gone on to? The old missile age, where rockets have taken over. I personally think that we will see a return to the gun destroyer. I can't see this thing carrying on. Well, now, that completes that part of it.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.